Welcome to the Bow Hunter Podcast. All bow hunting, all the time. Now, here are your hosts, editor Christian Berg and associate editor Mark Demko.
All right, welcome back to the Bow Hunter Podcast. We are all bow hunting all the time. It's early morning on a Friday, Mr. Demko. I'm just trying to get some caffeine into my system. And our guest is ready for a stand-up comedy routine.
Absolutely. You know, I'm actually pretty thrilled. We have one of our longest running columnists, CJ Winan, here with us this morning. He's busy working on a place he bought recently down in Maryland. So he's on the phone with us. Hopefully he can hold this call for the next 45 minutes to an hour, but pretty excited to chat with him about all things whitetail and hunting.
Absolutely. So, CJ, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for making time for us. You're down there on the Eastern Shore and living the good life.
Yes, sir. We've got deer, turkey, sika deer, which is just a very, very challenging, very, in fact, it's actually the smallest subspecies of elk in the world. And geese, ducks, we've got it all here. I'm just retired, and I'm getting the hunting shack all fixed up for next year already.
Well, and we had a chance back in December, Mark and I. It was very fortuitous timing on our part. We were down there for a sika deer hunt. We had a chance to see your new place. You got a great spot there, and I know you've been doing hot. Heck, you were working on it in December, and now it's May, so you've been putting a lot of hours into that place, and I know it's going to be just the perfect deer camp for us come this fall when we want to head back down there to hunt. We know we've always got an open invitation at your place, right, CJ?
Well, Mark. was that a little too quick for you, Christian?
Well, I told you I'm not really a morning person, and yeah, it's hard. It's hard for me to come up with a witty retort at this hour. I'm at a bit of a disadvantage. But it's understood. And for those of you who don't know, CJ, shame on you. I mean, he's world famous in the world of deer hunting. He is our hunting whitetails columnist and has been at Bowhunter Magazine for quite a while, certainly a lot longer than Mr. Demko and I have been on staff, because we're the Johnny Come Latelys over here at Bowhunter, CJ.
Oh, yeah, I've been doing this for 25 years, and my niche in the outdoor writing field is I take biological papers, peer-reviewed papers, a lot of college, universities, DNRs, and they're published, and I take out the quote-unquote big college words and put them on a fifth-grade education level. In other words, Dr. Carl Miller, University of Georgia, found that deer spend 85% of their activity at scrapes at night or at day. He'll figure it out using some grad students or some own research that he's done. And let me pick on you, Christian. That was a question. 85% of all buck visits at scrapes, when do they occur? Nighttime or daytime?
Well, if it's a binary choice, I'm going to say nighttime.
You're 100% correct. See, I can always pick out the poachers because they know that all those deer come in at nighttime. Poachers know that answer. Are you waking up yet, Christian?
Obviously not, because I can't even really deny your accusation. I will say that one of my favorite sayings is that I've always found the deer hunting to be better after dark than it is before dark. I mean, that's just a simple truth of the matter. If you're looking to kill the biggest bucks, yeah, about 2 to 4 a.m. is really, really good.
Yeah, I actually did a paper on that using Pope and Young data. Now, there's some noise in the data, but I wanted to find out for trophy buck, 125 inches or larger, when's the best time to harvest a record book buck, morning or afternoon? And part of the affidavit that all Pope and Young entries have to do is the time of kill. Now, again, there's some noise in this data, but what is it, morning or afternoon? This kind of surprised me. And again, there's no right or wrong answer. But Mark, what did you think, AM or PM?
You know, that's such a tough thing, depending on the situation, where you hunt, your local conditions. I tend to see more bucks in the morning, but if I'm trying to pattern one in specific, it seems to be best in the evening.
Oh, I love your answer. Believe it or not, it was afternoon. Now, I went back years, and my best time is by far in the morning on killing mature bucks. Definitely. I'm a morning person as it is. And again, there's some noise in the data because we don't know. Maybe 75% of all hunters are only hunting in the afternoon, not in the morning. So it makes it a little bit biased. But the data that they had at Pope and Young, it was definitely 65% afternoon, 35% in the morning. But again, site conditions and, you know, trail cam pictures, every buck is different, of course, has its own personality. Some are morning, some are afternoon. Some put up with a lot of disturbance, some don't. So it's a site-by-site scenario. But if I had a guess, I would have said morning, and I was definitely in the minority for the Pope and Young data.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, CJ, is Christian's not out there, and a bunch of other guys. We're just not out there in the morning because we couldn't get out of bed. So there's probably a little bit of bias in the data. But in all seriousness, I will say this. It's been a transition for me because I really did hunt a lot more in the mornings when I was younger. And since I've been in the industry and I've got, you know, a little more flexibility and freedom probably than the average bow hunter, if I can get out in the afternoons, you know, semi-regularly, I'll just concentrate on afternoons. But I've actually, you know, I've had a lot more success over the last 10 years in the afternoons, evenings, than I have in the mornings. And thanks for completely deadpanning my comment about the 2 a.m. hunts. You didn't dispute that at all. I'm pretty sure that everybody's listening, you know, thinks that I actually kill a lot of my deer after dark now. So I just want to go on record saying that that's in fact not the case.
Well, thank you for clarifying that, because as we went on, I was thinking we need to change the podcast name to The Outlaws.
Oh, you know, might be a good secondary stream that we could do as we continue to grow. And speaking of continuing to grow, gentlemen, as you're gathering your next question for CJ, Mark, I need to, before we get too much deeper into the weeds here, remind everybody that the Bowhunter Podcast is brought to you by Lancaster Archery Supply. For all your bow hunting needs, visit LancasterArchery.com. Why, you ask? Well, I'll tell you why. Because they've got the gear, they've got the knowledge, and they've got the passion. And with that, Mr. Demko, I will turn it back to you and CJ.
Well, thank you, Christian. And, you know, I'm just really excited to talk with you, CJ. And I have a ton of questions, but, you know, you mentioned that you've been diving into, you know, the data with research papers and the works of biologists across the country for, you know, over a quarter century. And I wanted to ask you, what's the most interesting thing that you found? Is there anything that in doing your work for the past 25 plus years, even you were surprised and made you go, oh, wow, did something jump out at you as far as maybe a controversial topic or something that you just had never thought of? Does something come to mind?
Yeah, the number one question I get with a magazine or the internet is you get a bunch of younger hunters. They want to be deer biologists, and you know what school to go to. And I always say it's the top three: your University of Georgia, Mississippi State University, and Texas A&M Kingsville down South Texas. And they're more management, boots on the ground type of deal. To get a job as a wildlife biologist, you're almost minimal. You have to have a master's degree. And that's a commitment. That's definitely a commitment because you learn about research and the correct way of, you know, actually conducting research. One of the things that we have found, mainly through Bowhunter TV, For years, I mean, for decades, we know that deer duck the string. You know, how do you miss a deer at 20 yards? Its head is down. It's feeding. It has no idea you're there, and you're shooting whatever the highest octane bow you can handle these days, and you just plain out miss it. Well, what we have found is through a lot of the video work and slow motion video, what is the best position for a deer? Say it's a broadside to you and its head's down. Well, that's dead deer, right? Question mark. Or do you shoot that deer that's 20 yards away broadside with its head up? Now, for years, let's rephrase that, for decades, we would always shoot the deer with its head down. Isn't that right, Mark?
That would have been, yeah, absolutely. That's the first thing that comes to my mind.
Yeah, we're wrong. Dead wrong. What we're finding out with some slow motion video is that when a deer comes in and its head's down, it's feeding, it's up, of course, it's not looking at you. Carefully, don't want to shoot a deer looking at you, but its head's up looking straight away or perpendicular to you. That's the best time to shoot the deer with its head up, not head down. And basically what we found is when its head's down, all it has to do is basically shift its weight to the back legs and then spring forward. When its head is up, it first then has to drop, back up, and then spring forward. It takes a half a second, if that, longer, but that's that half second is significant on having the arrow, and again, I'm talking just average arrow flight, speed, velocity, everything, on nailing the deer. When the deer is up, that half second is going to go straight down. It's going to put the weight on its back hind legs, and then it's going to spring forward. That's the best time to shoot a deer. When the head is down, it does not have to decrease the height from neck up to neck down. The neck is already down, so all it has to do is push back on the back legs and spring away. You know, we've missed too many of them within 20 yards, and the slow motion cameras are actually picking that up. So, you know, we've done this for decades. Head up, that's the best time to shoot to reduce deer ducking the string. Now, one of the questions, of course, that comes up with deer ducking the string, why do they duck the string? And there's a lot of controversy. There's no definitive answer on this. We would always say for years, well, it's the noise of the bow going off. It could be true. I would challenge you, because I don't believe that's correct. I don't think a deer can identify danger with the noise of the bow going off. I don't think they know what that is. But I would argue it's the arrow, the noise of the arrow. Mm-hmm. I would challenge you to do this. Go behind a barn or structure and have someone shoot an arrow at 20 yards. Listen to the arrow before it hits your block. Go out at 30 yards, listen to the arrow hit the block. Go out at 40 yards. The significance of different noises at different yardages is incredible. It's absolutely incredible. When I get in your space, your personal space, what do? We back up. And I think that's what's happening with the arrow. The arrow is getting in the deer's personal space. It now knows, oh, I better duck. When it's out of 20 yards, it's not moving. But how many times have we seen in Bowhunter TV? We're shooting thousands of frames per second. The deer has not moved. And here comes the arrow. We could see the arrow enter the frame, and the deer has still not moved. But as soon as it gets in that personal space, then it drops, ducks the arrow, and one of the hunters missed the deer. I would argue it's probably the arrow noise. And remember, years ago, wasn't that long ago, we would use feathers. And problem with feathers, of course, is the pluses and minuses is, of course, rain, wet conditions kind of knocks down your feathers. So we all went with vanes, but vanes are much more louder than feathers. So it's back and forth. we'll probably never know. I have never seen a research scenario with this. My good buddy, biologist, Dr. Grant Woods, did this a number of years ago on his website. It was fascinating. And then we did it a little bit on Bowhunter TV on all of us missing. And again, it happens. So the takeaway message is what you had asked, Mark, you know, what have we learned the last couple of decades from bow hunting is, of course, aim lower. We know that. But also head position of the deer. I would highly recommend head up versus head down. Choose the head up shot.
Well, I tell you what, CJ, this is really authoritative because not only are you a preeminent deer biologist, but you are also a noted authority on missing deer. So you are probably the best person that we could have gotten to go over this kind of material.
Could you hold on for a minute? I'm going to go back in the cry corner and get in the fetal position. I'll be back after I talk to my my counselor.
Well, I apologize, CJ. My coffee is kicking in now. And, you know, I kind of feel like I am able to put up a little bit of a fight. But now, in all seriousness, CJ, I'm glad that you said one thing, and that is you used the term ducking the string, because so often the colloquial phrase really most commonly within our bow hunting community is jumping the string. We say that the deer jumped the string. And of course, as you noted, you know, with Bow Hunter TV and so many other people videoing your hunts, what we've learned is, you know, the deer's not jumping anything. It's actually ducking. And even ducking is probably a little bit of a misnomer, because it's not that they're ducking the arrow. It's that they're doing exactly what you described. They want to flee. They want to exit the area post haste. And in order to do that, they're lowering their legs to load them up so that they can push off with those powerful hind legs that they have and use those big hamstring muscles to get the hell out of Dodge. And in order to do that, they have to crouch down. And so that's why it appears as though, you know, they're actually ducking the arrow. But like you said, maybe all they're really doing is hearing the arrow coming, not maybe even exactly knowing what it is, but just wanting to get away from it. And so by result of that, they lower their bodies. And that's why we shoot over the top of so many deer.
Yeah. And it's sad, but how many deer are missed? And we have no idea because we don't have a camera. Well, I guess I need to practice more. And the good thing on video, you could see where prior to the actual shot, you could see where the arrow will hit the deer. And at least a lot of boys on staff, 9 times out of 10, it may not be an X shot, but it's a 10 shot, and we still totally miss the deer. You know, and some deer are just much more skittier, like you boys up in Pennsylvania. I mean, you have, what is it, like 12 hunters per square mile? It's just insane. You know, they walk around with their head up in the air because there's so many hunters up in Pennsylvania versus down south. It's not nearly that type of pressure. So again, how skittish are the deer? One thing that I would point out that early in the season, again, this is my personal opinion, it could be wrong, but I would argue deer are not as skittish beginning of the season versus the near the end of the season. And so it's much easier to shoot a deer beginning versus late, just because they've learned. Hunters are in the woods, and it's right now. Get ready, boys.
Well, that's why I also come back to that again. You know, your productive hunting, not only are the big bucks moving there in the middle of the night, but when you put that spotlight in their eyes and squeeze the trigger, they never really seem to know what hit them, CJ.
Yeah, you know, it's another thing, it's new research going back to what Mark asked.
He is a man after your own heart, Mr. Demko, the way that he just deadpans that stuff and moves right on.
I was impressed when the joke comes in the other direction. I was really impressed there.
Well, here's something that's cool. Deer, we know, has a home range that we say 1 square mile. No, that's not really accurate, but it depends on habitat. Good habitat, small home ranges. Bad habitat, large home ranges. And we have what's called core area. Core area, by definition, is where deer spend 50% or more of its time. And like now, people are, antler sheds, big time passion for antler sheds. And I have a guy that does literally, he's a surveyor. He finds and actually puts a GPS on every single antler shed he finds. So he has a pretty good idea from year to year to year. And we know, of course, that deer will almost always within days, almost shed on the exact same day, year after year after year. Penn studies definitely show this. Wild deer is kind of harder to tell, but it's very close. And what we found is a lot of hunters will say, wow, I got to get into this area right here. We found a shed. Well, the core area in like winter is completely different than the core area than it is in summer, fall, or spring. It's always different. It moves. Core areas are dynamic, moving from one area to the next. A perfect scenario would be in the September, October, the first couple weeks of bow season. Deer are in velvet. We know that we're patterning them, and bam, 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 we got this deer pattern. And all of a sudden, velvet occurs, falls off, and then you don't see the deer for the rest of the season. What it's done, it's still within its home range, I guarantee you, but it moved its core area from that September, October timeframe to the rutting timeframe. The core areas are always moving. But what do we do as bow hunters? We set up our tree stands September, and guess what? We see him maybe the first week, and then he's gone. And then we say, oh, it's pressure. It's too much hunting pressure. He went nocturnal. Not necessarily. Deer obviously will be nocturnal, but a lot of the research with radio telemetry, what we find is the deer get up, say, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and then they just move to another area. The hunters who think they put too much pressure on them say, oh, they're nocturnal. Nope. All the deer's done is move from A to B within their home range, and guess what time they get up? 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the afternoon and start feeding. Their time has not changed. It's kind of like getting up in the morning. Some people get up early. Some people get up late. They're still there.
And some people like me are still asleep.
Literally. But it's not putting pressure per se. It's just they're moving to where it's safer. And you can start to see this depending on how many trail camera you have out there. You can see it. But it's harder to do with radio telemetry work and cellular technology we have right now. That's what we're finding out. They're just moving from point A to point B. What many hunters do, we keep hunting that same stand we set up in September. Our hunting stands should be dynamic. They should be moving from month to month to condition. And that's why, of course, tree saddles and climbing tree stands are always still so popular. It makes us more mobile.
Yeah, I wanted to come back, CJ. That's really good, and we can talk more about that. I wanted to close the loop on the ducking issue as well. You mentioned it briefly, and Bill Winky, who I know you're friends with as well, he's been a big proponent mm-hmm. to aiming lower, and you mentioned aiming lower. Yeah. And he talks about basically going for a heart shot as opposed to a double lunger. And he figures if the deer doesn't duck, he'll shoot it in the heart. And if it does duck, he'll shoot it in the lungs. And, he'll be better off that way. And that's kind of been his method. Do you think that's a good sort of, mitigation factor or whatever, like a fail safe for trying to shoot at a deer that you think might drop at the shot?
Yeah, I think Bill's halfway on there. The basically 1/3 up, 2/3 down. That's like within 20 yards. 1/3 up the chest, 2/3 down from the back. That's your point of aim. When it gets out past, depending on your bow and everything, 25, 30 yards, I'm putting it literally at the brisket, at the bottom of the chest for my bow speed at the bottom, because I know it's going to, I know it's going to duck. At 40 yards, I'll shoot, I'll even aim down below it at 40 yard shots. That's for my bow setup. Everyone's just a little bit different. Have you ever noticed when you do a hard shot, and this just blows me away, those deer run 100 yards plus a lot of times in hard shot. Everyone loves hard shots. Well, when you start actually mapping hard shots versus double long shots, those hard shot deer run and run and run and run.
Well, they
it's amazing.
Yeah, usually a hard shot deer will go on a what I call a death run. They'll do a dead sprint until they literally lose enough blood pressure to probably go unconscious on their feet and just fall face plant into the dirt, you know?
Yeah, I call it the J hook at the end. There's not enough oxygen going into the brain, so they get lightheaded. So they do a J hook near the end, left, right, you know, it all depends on terrain, which way they turn. But basically what happens when you do a double lung, there's no oxygenated blood. The blood's pumping, but there's no oxygenated blood, so they don't travel as far. With the heart being hit, there's still oxygenated blood within the body, so they can run a little bit further than normal. But, you know, hard shots are, you know, great, but I hate tracking. They're just, they run further than double lung. So that's why when Bill said hit, you know, I agree with what he said, but I just don't like tracking hard shot deer. They go too far.
Well, I don't know. There's usually a decent blood trail, but I do affirm what you've said about the double lung. I mean, heck, I think if you've killed enough deer, you know, I've had it. You've certainly had it, I'm sure. Sometimes you double lung a deer, especially really close, you know, like a deer's 10 yards away. You make a nice shot. You double lung the deer. The arrow zips through them so quick. I've had them where they just kind of flinch and then they just stand there and look around and they're like, what in the world just happened? And literally right. Then take like two or three steps and just fall over. It's unbelievable.
Fall over dead.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like when you're cutting up celery for the turkey, you know, Thanksgiving, and you're not paying attention and oops, you cut off the end of your finger. You don't feel it. And then there's blood. Same thing. If an arrow doesn't hit bone, it's a scalpel going straight through. And just like you don't know you cut yourself when you're cutting up celery or whatever for Thanksgiving dinner, same thing for the deer. If it goes right through, yeah, you know, it don't even know something happened. Well, it happened, then all of a sudden it falls over dead.
You know, I've said this kind of morbid, I guess, but like in all honesty, like I don't think it's that bad of a way to go. From what I've observed on deer that, like, I don't think the deer really knows what just happened. And then it's literally only, you know, 10, 15 seconds and they're unconscious. I was like, man, I don't think there was a whole lot of suffering right there. I don't think there was any suffering.
Yeah, it's hydrostatic shock versus hemorrhage. Well, the rifle, there's a little bit of energy, or it's a lot of energy, which causes all that blood tissue to explode. That when that explodes, that causes pressure. And the pressure, the increased pressure, swells up all the muscles, so all the blood is internal, not external. And that swelling, i.e., could cause more pain than a slice of a scalpel going through. They don't even feel it, and they just literally bleed out. So what you're saying, we're doing this right now to the European Bow Hunting Association. We have to prove biologically and physiology from a physiological standpoint, the pain issue. And that's what we're finding out. If you have a choice between a rifle or a bow is way times much, much better to go. And we can just, in our own country, just 100 years ago or plus, when we were fighting the Indians, you had a much better chance of survival with a bow shot versus a gunshot when we were using arrows, bows and arrows versus, you know, muzzle loaders and everything back then.
Yeah. You want to jump in here, Mark? I know that you've probably got a list of thoughts running here.
Well, yeah, I mean, first off, that was just a fascinating analogy there. But I had one last question on ducking the string. And I don't think we mentioned this, but we talked about they can duck the string substantially. You looking at all the video over the years, what is the range or the distance you've seen deer duck the string? Is it much more than a foot? Is it just a couple inches to 20 inches? What have you seen there? I was fascinated by that.
Yeah, depending on the distance of the shot, you know, we've had deer literally standing, and the deer stands about, you know, 32 inches of tabletop from the back of its back, and its chest will literally hit the ground. So over a foot, is that doable? Yes. Another thing to consider your shot, we all just assume, like you just did right there, Mark, that we shoot a deer on level ground. Well, what about if the deer's going uphill? What if it's going downhill? That fulcrum where it puts its back weight is completely different. When it's going uphill, it's much easier for it to duck versus going downhill, for it to duck, bring back, and go forward. So depending on the topography, that's another scenario you have to look with. When they're 20 yards away going uphill, I'm going to aim a little bit lower. And not every time can you get a shot with the head up. Those seconds right before your shot are critical, but it's not always perfect. You know, do I still shoot deer with their head down? Well, of course I do. It's either now or never. I'm going to have to get it. And I'll shoot, but knowing that it's going to duck a little bit more with the head down more, and that's just experience. Every scenario is different, of course.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing I really want to know, and CJ, is what's the most controversial topic you've covered in years where maybe you just got a ton of feedback, or it's even conversations between you and other biologists or circles or friends, or something that just seems to come up outside of jumping or ducking the string? Is it chronic wasting disease? Is it something else that we're not thinking about that just seems to always come up in conversation?
Yeah, it's CWD right now within the biology world, how we're handling it. And again, we're still in the genesis of how to handle this disease. There's no cure. It's scary. Data out of Wisconsin, or the epicenter, it's primarily affecting CWD mature bucks 3.5 years or older. Now imagine you put all this time and energy and money into producing quality deer, and in 3.5 years, they're all dying. You never even get a chance to hunt them. That's a biggie. And of course, with the incubation period of 2 years, that's just, you have no idea. You just have no idea. From the hunting side, of course, it's of course crossbows. We can do another podcast on that, because I got a lot of data from the magazine from state deer biologists, how that's affecting the deer herd. And it's just not. I've got the numbers from everyone in the country. We're not negatively affecting our deer herd. But between CWD and crossbows, that's the two biggies, you know, in the last 20 years for sure.
Yeah. And boy, those could be separate episodes. We don't really have time, Mark, to dive into either of those topics, CWD or crossbows here.
Yeah.
Suffice it to say, I'll do a tease, okay, with this, CJ. We'll have to have you back. Maybe we'll get our good buddy Jason Snavely and get him on there as well, because I'm a little bit with Jason. I'm a bit of a contrarian on CWD. Not that I think it's good by any means, but you know, you used a phrase, how we, you know, we're at sort of the genesis of how we handle it. And, you know, I was just thinking, I'm like, well, maybe we don't handle it. In other words, I don't know that mankind or the wildlife biology community is going to come up with a silver bullet for this thing. But at the same time, I would just say, and this is a tease, you know, for a future discussion, I don't know that it's going to be, you know, the mass death of all deer and deer hunting that we feared for a while. I think it's going to be okay. And it's going to be end up being one of those things that we just have to deal with on a long-term basis.
Yeah. I mean, back in the 30s and 40s, the big thing was screw worm. And that was devastating to the deer herd. It just was. And, you know, we came up with a solution for that. No one remembers it anymore, but it was devastating to deer, especially down south.
Screw worm. In the 30s. I wonder, is that where the phrase getting, you know, that you're screwed? You get screw worms? And what did it do? Is it a brain worm or what?
No, it's just a parasite. It would affect deer. And it was mainly down south. But yeah, it was very, very bad way back when. And again, any kind of disease, it starts slow and then increases, and then you get exponential killing. And that's what biologists are very concerned, that we don't hit that point, that we're just increasing, that it doesn't go up exponentially. That's what we're scared about.
Right.
That would devastate everything. And again, there's all kinds of pluses and minuses in what we do. So biologists are conservative by nature, better safe than sorry. But yeah, time will tell.
I know it's not a perfect analogy by any means. It's, you know, two totally different kinds of disease. But I think of another situation that we all experienced in recent memory that we were better safe than sorry on, called COVID. And I didn't really like the way that turned out and how it was handled. And hindsight being 2020, I think we realized we could have made a lot of different decisions there. So hopefully we'll be a little more measured in our approach as we grapple with CWD.
Yeah, time will tell. Obviously our numbers are going down, but at the same time, what's our future look like? I thoroughly believe, and this could be way out in left field, but we've only had the pill for people, you know, I think since the 50s or 60s, you know, basically 50, 60 years. I thoroughly believe in the next generation, we will have a species-specific contraceptive for critters. So they come to the corn, they eat the bait, and they become sterile. And again, I could be out left field on this, granted, but the technology and genetics work that's being done, it is scary. It's just scary. If that would happen, hunters would be obsolete. Totally.
If they could come up with something like that. They could come up with something like that to only target guys like you and me, CJ. So there's going to be no more CJs and Christians. And then, you know, everyone will be like Demko, and the world will be like a much more efficient, rational place.
Well, he'll get it done. He can tip some deer over too. I heard that.
Oh, he's a stone cold killer. Isn't that right, Mr. Demko?
I do my best. Hey, I had to ask you about one thing, CJ, because I know we're probably getting close to time on this episode. It's my understanding that you have an opportunity every June to go out and do some bow fishing down where you live. Can you talk a little bit about that before we wrap up? Because it's just fascinating to me, and I'll tell you why. You go after skate, and some people may disagree with me, but the wings are just amazing eating.
Yeah, they taste like scallops, stingrays. We have two here in Maryland. One is the cow nose, which is very, very popular throughout the East Coast. And the other one's the southern ray. Southern rays are round circles, and the cow nose are kind of like triangles. And you shoot them out of the boat. You come in, a lot of the watermen hate them because they eat crabs. And crabs is that's how they make their living here in Maryland, with the blue crabs. So we're out in the water with our bows and our bow setups, and then somebody we don't even know get over here. They're yelling at us to get over here because the stingrays are doing their migration from the Caribbean the whole way up to Maine. And you go up to them, they you know, flap their wings, and you go up and get a shot. Then reel them in. They literally taste like scallops. You get two fillets on the top, you get two fillets on the bottom. We just have a hoot. It is a ball. Stingray, it's something to do in the summer, and it humbles you on your shots. It's oh my gosh! Just when you think, oh, I got this down, no, you don't. And every year we do it, we have to re-educate ourselves on the shot placement through the water because it's a whole different animal than that. And it's just a ball. It's fun. The kids do it. We got kids, you know, 12-year-old stingrays skates with us. It's a hoot.
Well, we're looking forward to our invitation for Mark and I to come down. My bow fishing rig is all set up and ready on its hook in the basement. So you just let us know, CJ, when those rays are infesting your local waters.
Yeah, I've already talked to Mark. Mark's coming down June 15th. This is awkward.
Just Mark, though, right?
I'm not sure that's how the conversation went, and I would never go without inviting the boss, to be clear.
I think CJ has just been a little bruised in the ego since I came down there in December and went home with a really nice Sika stag. And I think CJ was saying, like, man, I've been hunting my whole life and I just never was able to get one like that, Berg. And you came down here in just a few days and did it.
Yeah, I got to say, that was the first time we saw him in. That was the first time we did see you in the fetal corner, CJ. I was pretty impressed. I mean, you handled yourself well. It was a mix between composure and letting your emotions out. So it was a pretty wonderful thing to see.
Oh, that stag was phenomenal. Phenomenal. You have no idea still how people hunt them their whole life and don't shoot one as big as you did. That was an incredible stag. And for the record, mine was 2 inches larger than yours, Christian, just so you know.
We are talking about stags here, right?
I'll let you fill in the blank.
Well, honestly, I got to give a shout out to TJ Jenkins from Muddy Marsh Outfitters because, they're right down the road from your new place there. And so that's why we were able to spend some time. And TJ does a great job. And, you know, I mean, I made the shot, but TJ put me in the spot. So it really worked out.
He's the man.
Yep.
He's the man. I would argue, you know, I've been all over North America just hunting critters. I would argue a Sika deer here in Maryland. I mean, the stags are, yours is huge, probably 120 pounds live weight. It is probably one of the more challenging critters in North America to down with a bow. They're tough. They are just tough.
Well,
and that's what drives me nuts about them.
They're tough and they're tough to track because, you know, and again, we can't spend too much time on this, but like, I mean, the darn thing was standing in the water when I shot it. Cause like where they live is the swamp and it's half dry land and half water. And you have to track these things. They're running through the swamp. And so you have kind of sporadic sign and it can get washed off or disappear in the water and whatnot. So you kind of got to listen. That's one thing about the swamp, I guess, that gives you somewhat of an advantage is if you're in the stand, you know, you talked about that J hook. I listened to my stag run off and I kind of knew, you know, where it ran. And then it sounded like it did like that right hand turn. And then there was some thrashing around. And so I felt like I had kind of a general idea of the neighborhood where it had ended up, but yeah, it's not easy to track in that environment.
Not at all. I'll tell you another little trick. Luminox are wonderful in that environment because you're only, and you all, both of you all know you're only 20, 25 yards away and you can't see one another. It's that thick. But when you take a Luminox out of your quiver, oh, he's over there. You could see the Luminox at nighttime to help find one another and to find stags or hinds, whatever you shoot.
Well, I hope we have more opportunities to do some of that in the years ahead. And Maryland is a little bit underrated, Mr. Demko, when you think about it. It's probably best known for, you know, what CJ said, like crabs and some of the fishing, waterfowling for sure. But the big game hunting side of Maryland doesn't get as much attention as it probably deserves, Mark.
Yeah, absolutely agree. You know, we talked about the Sitka deer, but also great whitetail hunting. They have some really big bucks on the eastern shore there, turkey hunting. CJ, you have a house in another part of the state, and I believe you have some really nice bucks there, but also really strong deer numbers, maybe too many deer in certain spots. Talk a little bit about that. You said the hunting can be pretty solid there in archery season.
Yeah, it's again, the quantity versus quality. Quality, of course, is eastern shore quantities in the backyard. It's strange. I still get this today. You know, I still knock on doors and can I have permission to hunt? And it's so strange. And someone goes, oh my gosh, these people, you know, not to say they're all doctors and lawyers, but they just have no idea who hunters are. And yes, I would love you to hunt the property. Then the next question, and how do you answer this, Mark? How much do you charge? That's what they ask me. They're willing.
I've never had anybody ask me that.
Tell them $100 a deer for every deer you shoot. They send you home with the deer and $100 cash.
Well, pretty close is what we do. We have one of the better, it's called Farmers and Hunters Feeding the Hungry. So they'll donate $50, $75, $100, and that pays for the butchering. And it's a tax write-off. So that's part of our package that we give to landowners. So it helps us shoot more deer, and it helps the hungry. Each deer, an average 100-pound dress weight deer, is literally equivalent to about 200 quarter-pounders. And when you go to food banks, the one commodity needed at all food banks across the country, the top three items are meat, meat, and meat. The only time they get meat is Thanksgiving and Christmas, and 9 times out of 10, it's turkeys. But they love venison, and you can, of course, you know, have 1,000 different meals with venison. And it's 100% organic, as you all know.
Yep. Good stuff, CJ. Good stuff. Well, I think we got to wrap it up, Mr. Demko, for today. But you put in our notes for future shows. We could probably do an hour with CJ about urban and suburban hunting and using that to not only control deer numbers, but support, you know, feeding the hungry. We could probably do a whole hour on CWD. There was another topic in there that I can't remember that we could do a whole hour on. So, man, this guy is a treasure trove. And that's why, if you don't already get Bowhunter Magazine, you want to make sure you've got a subscription so you can catch CJ's Hunting Whitetails column and get all of his wisdom on a sort of an ongoing basis. It's kind of like my daily cup of coffee and caffeine. I got to have CJ on a regular basis. It keeps my system regular.
No comment, but that was pretty quick.
I mean, you know, I've perked up a little bit as the coffee has kicked in throughout the show. So it's always a pleasure, CJ, and I really thank you for making time. You know, we had a better guest lined up for a couple days ago for next week's show, and he kind of blew us off. So we had to go to plan B. That guy wasn't available either. But anyway, we were really glad that you could make some time for us.
No problem. My pleasure.
Oh, my gosh. You are a prince, a real prince.
This is why Mark's invited to go hunt stingrays and you're not. Just saying.
Mr. Demko, I'm in the doghouse. Will you take us out?
I will. Well, this was one of my favorite podcast episodes ever. And Christian, as you are ramping up, CJ is winding down. So CJ, thanks so much for sharing some of the the knowledge and the research that you've been gathering over the decades, and for being such a wonderful and knowledgeable contributor to Bowhunter. And hey, everybody, we'll see you next time on the Bowhunter Podcast.
Thanks for downloading the Bowhunter Podcast. All bow hunting, all the time. Pick up the latest issue of Bowhunter Magazine on your local newsstand, or connect with us online at bowhunter.com.